You're listening to a recording of the Open Society Foundations, working to build vibrant and tolerant democracies worldwide. Visit us at soros.org.
Good evening. I'm very pleased to welcome you here this evening. I'm Arye Nair. I'm president of the Open Society Foundations. And I think this is an extraordinary opportunity to hear from as knowledgeable and distinguished a panel as we could put together, as we could possibly put together, about the effort that is now underway to reform the libel law in the United Kingdom, which has had an impact on freedom of expression far beyond the borders of the United Kingdom. The speakers this evening, and I'm going to be very brief in introducing them, although they have many illustrious credentials that I will not mention. But the speakers this evening, in the order in which they will speak, are John Kampfner, who is the director or chief executive of Index on Censorship, a journalist with extensive experience, including having served as the editor of the New Statesman. And Index on Censorship, under his leadership, has played a crucial role in launching the campaign to reform the libel law in the United Kingdom. I will then call upon Victor Kovner, a prominent lawyer here in New York City, who has been a litigator in a large number of cases involving freedom of expression. And his career includes service as the Corporation Counsel of the City of New York, which I think means that you commanded the largest number of lawyers in the city.
Outside of the Justice Department.
Outside of the Justice Department, okay. And how many were there?
At that time, 525, now 675.
Okay. And then the final speaker will be Anthony Lester, Lord Lester. He is a world-renowned human rights lawyer, active in freedom of expression cases in many jurisdictions. I recall one occasion seeing him after one of his clients in Singapore had just been released from prison, and seeing him quite ecstatic about that achievement. He has been the principal person in the British Parliament driving the effort to reform the United Kingdom libel law. And before you start, John, I have to announce that the event is being recorded, and therefore that anyone who takes part in the discussion will have their comments permanently preserved, and I will ask you, if you ask a question, to speak into the microphone. John?
Thank you. Thank you very much indeed, Arye, and good evening, ladies and gentlemen. It's a great pleasure to be here with a distinguished panel and a distinguished audience. The first thing I would like to say is that none of our efforts at Index, together with our friends and colleagues at English Pen, would have been possible had we not received the support of the Open Society Institute. It just simply, from our perspective, would not have happened. It would be probably presumptuous of me to say, and history and law wouldn't be in the place it is now, but I would certainly say that everything the OSI has done through REA here and through the London office has been extraordinarily helpful, indeed essential to this process. I'll just talk very briefly about the campaign, the politics of the campaign, and what we did and where we are now. And as an addendum, our hope, together perhaps with OSI and or with others, to export our campaign, to export the methodology of the campaign to other jurisdictions where reform of libel is essential. The reform of English libel law, always have to emphasize it's England because the Scots, as ever, have it better, and their libel jurisdiction is less weighted against free expression. But English libel law and the reform of it and the iniquities of it are not a subject for the UK or for England. As many of you here in the audience will know, it's a global problem, and many have suffered globally at the hands of courts in London. And to use that old adage, which we do love to use from time to time, our capital city became known as the town called Sue. It is a place of great indulgence towards the rich and the famous, the oligarchs and the sheikhs, who have used our jurisdiction to chill the free speech, not just of journalists and the media. And we keep on saying to our detractors, who happen to be a fairly small but powerful subset of the legal profession, namely those claimant firms who will see their profit margins potentially damaged, that we are not representing the media. We are not doing the media's bidding. This is about the principle of free expression. And many, indeed most, of the examples we cited in our campaign were those of individual bloggers, activists, authors, scientists, doctors, and the like. So how did we get here? Well, we, as our two organizations, we were very much spurred on by the UN Human Rights Committee's report in July 2008 that suggested that English libel law might indeed breach Article 19. Which of itself, I mean, the report was coruscating about the state of English libel law. From that point, quietly and below the radar, we spent the next year talking to editors, lawyers, and others about their experiences and collecting a database of experience, because one of the problems with libel is that it is not, the problem is not restricted to the number of cases that get to court. Those are the well-known ones and the famous ones. It's the many thousands of people who don't say things, who self-censor, who erase sentences, whole chapters from their books, from their NGOs, from their human rights surveys of particular countries, scientists, who trim what they say in peer-reviewed journals, doctors and the like. And those that slipped through the net and did say things and then got sued, they were the most famous cases, but they were but a microcosm, I would argue, and we argued, of the bigger problem which we sought to quantify. So we, these two organizations, published our initial report in November 2009. At the time we did that, apart from the Liberal Democrats, who were then regarded as the smaller of the two opposition parties, of which Anthony is a prominent member, they were signed up to libel reform and have been for many years, but the two main parties were effectively not interested. Within 6 to 8 weeks, the then Justice Secretary, Jack Straw, conceded and established at the Ministry of Justice a working party on libel. Fast forward to the UK general election of May 2010, and we had managed to procure from all three main parties commitments in their general election manifestos to reform of libel. Now, okay, they were just state one-line statements of principle, but that of itself was a remarkable turnaround in less than 6 months. Straight after the general election, and he will give, Lord Leicester will give you from the horse's mouth the details of it, he introduced his private member's bill, which advocated thorough reform in all its manifestations of UK defamation. That was then adopted and adapted by the new Conservative Liberal coalition government, which in March 2011, so what is that, 7 months ago, published its draft defamation bill. And under the that interpretation of the Constitution, it was then going to be put to a joint parliamentary committee of the House of Lords and the House of Commons to do the detailed pre-legislative scrutiny before it is formally introduced into a parliament as a final bill. So that work took place in the spring and the summer, and we and many others presented our evidence in written and in oral form to that. At the same time, the Ministry of Justice was doing its own internal review to improve the draft bill, which we regarded as a good bill, but in several important areas. The public interest defense needed to be shored up. The bar for corporations to sue, in our opinion, was too weak. And the protection for internet service providers was unclear. Those were the three areas. There were other smaller ones, but those were the three main areas that we lobbied for change. So on Tuesday of this week, 2 days ago, this joint committee released its report under embargo for Wednesday morning. It marked a considerable improvement on the already quite reasonable draft bill. Again, I will leave it to the greater and the better, the lawyers in on the panel, to explain it in detail, but I have it here. Some slight curiosities on libel tourism and some one or two areas that we weren't entirely happy about. But still, if we regarded the draft bill as sort of 50% there, this was certainly 60 or 70 or 75% there, a definite improvement. The biggest impediment and the biggest concern we had was related less to the substance of the bill and more to the context of the bill, and Harry Evans and others will be very familiar with this, and that is the phone hacking scandal in the UK. There are three areas of the UK media that are currently being seen within the same prism, and indeed the Culture Select Committee of the House of Commons in March 2010 published a report putting together libel reform, privacy, and press standards. So we had this egregious case of corporate bullying, of political subservience, and very poor journalism, and illegal actions without public interest that blew up, as you all know, very dramatically. It had been bubbling under, and The Guardian had been working on it with very little traction from the political class. But then it blew up in July. The government asked Lord Justice Leveson to undertake an inquiry into the whole panoply of the way the media conducts itself, which we supported, and we have no problem. In fact, we have much, in our view, free expression and high journalistic standards are concomitants. They're not in any way a threat to each other. They're absolutely symbiotic. They need each other. But our concern was that the government would use the Leveson inquiry, which will take a full 1 year to produce it, the first half of its report, to hide behind it and to delay publishing the final libel bill. So in my, I had to do a formal presentation to Lord Leveson last Wednesday, and in my formal presentation to him, I urged him to make it clear to ministers and for the public record that he had no locus in libel reform, and that he had no intention of delaying libel reform. And that I reinforced on publication of the Joint Committee's report on libel in an op-ed for The Guardian published yesterday morning. And the hottest news off the press, I can say, just as I was leaving for Washington yesterday from London, was I got a call from 10 Downing Street saying, we hear what you say, we are not going to delay. This will be published next May without, we have no intention to hide behind Leveson. If they are good to their word, and it was only a telephone call, then we are looking at no delay, and we are down to the final stretch, which is some very important arguing over some outstanding specifics on the bill. So much more to be said, but I think it's probably right now to hand over. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Victor?
Thank you, REA. I'm delighted to be here. First, I want to make clear that although I do practice law and represent many media organizations, and I'm in a large firm, Davis Wright Tremaine, which does a lot of that work, I'm not speaking for my clients today or for my partners, many of whom disagree with some of the things I'm going to say, but I'll give you my views on these subjects formed over a great many years. Let me start by placing the context, and I can obviously speak as an American lawyer over my sense and of the significance of the change that we are soon to see in the United Kingdom and elsewhere, but it's very hard for me to evaluate its impact in the UK itself. But let me set the stage by saying what American publishers now face, have faced for many years, and face to this day, and probably into 2012, if one of their publications, a magazine, an internet publication, newspaper, or other document, even though it has limited circulation in the United Kingdom, and if it may offend the sensibilities of the powerful, even if it those sensibilities are of an American citizen or of a non-resident of the UK, that publication will receive a threatening letter from a lawyer, claimants' counsel, we say plaintiffs, in the UK and often in the Republic of Ireland and from Northern Ireland as well, making extravagant demands for retractions and payments of money in very large amounts that would startle people, because you must remember that though not to be changed in this litigation, in the UK, the successful plaintiff also recovers his or her fees and costs, they call them, and they are very large indeed. And the practice has been for people to enter into contingent arrangements, conditional fee arrangements, I think they're called in the UK, in which there is a success fee, so that anything that the plaintiff may recover will be in effect doubled. And it is a rather daunting threat, even if the number of copies of the particular publication are relatively limited. And the unhappy truth is that many American publishers have succumbed to these threats. A few have had the courage to successfully resist them. I see a couple of their counsel in this room. But the intimidating landscape in terms of Americans looking at US, British law, if they have assets in Great Britain, has been daunting. Now, last year, the United States adopted something called the Speech Act, or dealing with what's called libel terrorism, in which we wouldn't, as a nation, did I say terrorism? That was called terrorism. It's libel tourism, although some called it libel terrorism. So we won't, United States courts will not enforce judgments in the United States that have been obtained in regimes which have procedures which do not accommodate our First Amendment values and some related procedures which are significant. That doesn't, that's a very helpful step, but it doesn't deal with the problem with, for companies who have assets in the United Kingdom, who have been forced into, have had essentially their speech suppressed and have forced into settlements that are outrageous. So we are, what we are considering now, or what the UK is considering, is really a sea change. This is a momentous occasion, and where Lord Leicester will go through the procedures that have yet to take place, but there is a fundamental change here, and it will enhance speech not only in the United Kingdom, but elsewhere. And I want to say just at the outset, we've moved as far as we have, largely because of the courage and thoughtfulness of Lord Leicester, who is with us today. This would not have gotten as far without him. It is a major moment. Now, I have a few comments on the law itself. First of all, though the bills are limited to England and Wales, the impact of the legislation is likely to go far beyond. I was at as was Lord Leicester, at a Media Law Resource Center conference in London last month, and there were lawyers from various parts of the world who regularly attend this conference, many of whom who said that their nations are waiting to hear what the United Kingdom does and in terms of their own laws. And it's fair to say that the changes the UK makes will influence comparable changes in Australia, New Zealand, South Africa, Canada, and to a lesser extent within the EU. I would hope it would reach Ireland, but I'm not so optimistic. Let me touch on some of the principal issues, and I'd like to talk about a recent case which will help clarify and some of the impact of some of the changes. First of all, substantial harm. The bills would impose the burden of proving that harm to reputation is substantial, and it will place that burden on the plaintiff. That's a significant change, and the Mawinney report, which was handed out as you came in, and it's the report of the joint committee of the House of Commons and the House of Lords, which has been reviewing Lord Leicester's bill and the government's bill, is a very positive development. All of us have not fully absorbed it because it only reached our offices today, but they've actually gone beyond and asked and imposed a burden of establishing serious and substantial harm. I don't know that it's a major difference, but it tells you where the government is coming from. How one, a corporate plaintiff, can establish substantial harm is also discussed in the Mawinney report, which emphasized that mere injury to goodwill would not be recoverable, as opposed to substantial loss of customers directly caused by the libelous language. That's for a corporate plaintiff. They say mere decline in stock price would be insufficient. So this change will limit claims to language capable of causing real harm to reputation, not mere disagreeable press coverage. And plaintiffs with bad reputations will not be permitted to waste the time of the court. A second significant change is the provision for honest opinion. Defendants will be able to rely on the defense of honest opinion if the matter is in the public interest on the basis of facts existing at the time of publication. While not as broad as our protection under our Constitution for opinion, which is absolutely protected, it is an expansion of the UK defense of fair comment. I'd like to talk about a recent case that just came down in the High Court of Justice in London, because it dramatizes some of these two changes and others. There, a right-wing billionaire, casino owner from Las Vegas, named Sheldon Adelson, some of you may know of him, sued two labor officials for statements made at a fringe meeting at the Labor Party conference in Brighton in 2004. And the gist of the language in suit there was as follows. Las Vegas Sands has a terrible reputation in the U.S. Everyone should work with the GMB, the government body dealing with gambling, to stop them from even entering the U.S. market. Sheldon Adelson is Sands. He is an aggressive man. He had peaceful protesters forcibly removed because he said they were on his property. Sheldon Adelson is perhaps the most vilified man in Nevada. He engages in very aggressive lobbying. He is egomaniacal. Mr. Adelson clearly demonstrates that the problems he will bring will far outweigh any advantages. Now, it took roughly 7 years to have this claim dismissed in an excellent, though somewhat convoluted, opinion of Justice Tugendhat, who now sits on most of the libel cases in London. To have brought this case in the United States on this language would have been laughable and would have been quickly dismissed. Obviously, but under the new law, the corporate plaintiff here, the Sands, could not have established serious or substantial harm deriving from such language. And it's clear that the language would have been protected by the honest opinion privilege. It's simply an example of the kind of claims which have clogged and the British courts and have led to near extortionate settlements because of the costs provisions that I hope will be substantially alleviated. I don't want to go on to all the changes because I want to hear from Lord Leicester as to which he thinks are most important, but I do want to just touch on a couple of points. One is single publication rule. Lord Leicester has proposed, and now it has been generally accepted, that the single publication rule will be adopted, and it will bring the United Kingdom into the 21st century directly from the 19th. I can't tell you how important this is as a media lawyer, and that's the law is, once the material is published, merely the fact that the same material continues to be issued doesn't give rise to a subsequent claim. It is so important and so overdue. I was very pleased to see that the bills had their own form of libel tourism in it, and they will give to the UK courts the discretion to not take cases simply because some copies have been distributed in the UK, and the courts can weigh whether, in context, whether another jurisdiction would be appropriate. That also is long overdue, but the point I'd like to most focus on is the safe harbor, because this is a continuing issue for media lawyers here and around the world, and because the internet obviously will continue to grow as ultimately the principal form of communication. The Mawhinney Report approves Lord Leicester's recommendation for a limited safe harbor in which a mere facilitator of the publication, that is the internet service provider, not the author of it, of the content, but the distributor, would not be liable unless the language was taken down within 14 days of notice. And the notice requires a written statement detailing the grounds upon which the matter is claimed to be defamatory. The remedy of notice and takedown is dramatically different from the absolute immunity provided by Section 230 of our Communications Decency Act. But speaking for myself, I think Lord Leicester's approach may well be preferable to our own. I've long had my reservations about the sweeping scope of Section 230. I realize that a notice and takedown regime is susceptible to abuse, the so-called heckler's veto, people jamming internet service providers with huge amounts of notice of demands for takedowns, but it is a measure that can be dealt with procedurally, in my view. And I note that in the Mawhinney report, They say where the author of the challenge statement on the internet is not disclosed, the language must be taken down upon receipt of a complaint unless the author identifies himself, in which case then a notice of complaint would be attached. That pressure on the anonymous speaker in the internet setting, which arises particularly in the area of cyberbullying, is very, very troublesome. And I have to say, I think that the major internet providers have obtained too sweeping protection in our country, and I think where the UK is headed is probably best. But even though the bills don't do everything that American media lawyers would dream about and provide all the protections our First Amendment provides, it is such a major advance that we are eager and deeply appreciative for your leadership.
That's as good as an introduction as one can get, so.
Can I just begin by explaining that Arié Naier is such an authoritative chair and leader that, as I said to him just before, the fact that he has subjected me to 10 hours and a quarter of sleep deprivation in continuous session, except for half an hour today, means I'm now in a state where if he said I should put my head in the oven, I surely would. It's a great pleasure to be here, but the trouble is I am so jet-lagged that I may find myself speaking for 3 hours instead of 20 or 15 minutes. It's a great pleasure to be doing it under Arié's chair. I also want to say that the gentleman who's adjusting my microphone, Sir Harry Evans, who has honored us with his presence, is the person for whom I did the first free speech case in Strasbourg when he was editor of the Sunday Times. It was the thalidomide case, and it was, for me, the most extraordinary experience in which we won by only one vote in Strasbourg when Harry and his paper had been prevented by the government from publishing information attributing negligence to the manufacturers and distributors of the drug thalidomide that had produced monster births in pregnant women. And my experience with Harry in those days has always remained with me. He alone among editors at the time understood the reasons why it was important to take cases of this kind. We tried to get the rest of the press on our side. In those days, dog ate dog, and we failed to do so. But last week, the week before last, Harry chaired a session in London with about 400 or 500 media people present. And for 1 hour and a half, he moderated the most extraordinary discussion without a note. And it's wonderful for me to speak in Harry's presence today. In 1961 or two, when I was studying at Harvard Law School, I was privileged to meet Justice Hugo Black in his Supreme Court. And when I met him, I said, I see you said, Justice, that you think that all libel laws are unconstitutional. Do you really mean that? Oh, yes, young man, he said, I mean it. And he drew out from his pocket a copy of the First Amendment. So I said, well, don't you make any exceptions at all? What about misleading advertising or the misuse of speech in labor disputes or race hate cases? And he looked at me and said, young man, not only do I suspect you of being at Harvard Law School, but I believe that you are taught by Paul Freund. And of course, that was true. And he then accused Paul Freund quite unfairly of censoring his own opinions. It was my introduction to the most dogmatic version of First Amendment religious jurisprudence, but tempered later, of course, by knowing Bill Brennan and the way in which he, much more careful and balanced and wise judge and author of New York Times and Sullivan, made me appreciate the virtues of the First Amendment. Now, I want to say a bit about American law, because we've heard a good deal about how bad English law is, but I would just like to say a few things about your law. There is a gulf between you and us, and most Americans would say that they are right and that Europe is wrong. But there is a gulf. The gulf partly consists in a failure to recognize a constitutional right of personal privacy against media intrusion. That was decided in the Time Inc. case, much criticized by Tony Lewis in his Make No Law great book. In Europe, we regard free speech as a fundamental right that has to be balanced against the rights of others, including the right to reputation and also the right to personal privacy. And so the idea of striking a balance between those rights is fundamental to the way in which European and UK courts approach the problem. And that is different from what happens here, at least in some respects. Another difference is that although you have constitutionalized your libel law through New York Times and Sullivan and subsequently, in a way that has diminished enthusiasm for libel law reform at the state level, where, of course, the law is to be found. And it always strikes me as astonishing, for example, that you don't cap damages in your libel cases in the way that our courts have done some time ago. We require libel damages, not cost, but libel damages, to be strictly proportionate. And that is not so. And of course, you still have juries. One of the things that's not been mentioned is that we are, I'm glad to say, making it very, very problematic to have juries in libel cases. Another difference is that, for example, your Supreme Court, by a majority, have decided in their wisdom or lack of it that there can be no cap on election expenses in the name of free speech. To the rest of the world, especially the European rest of the world, that seems to be undemocratic and violating the need for level playing fields in political speech and elections. So there are these very interesting and important differences. But what we get from the First Amendment, I suppose above all, and we get from New York Times and Sullivan, is the notion that civil libel law can have a greater chilling effect on free speech than criminal law, because civil law is much easier to demonstrate, and because the burden of proof is cast upon the defendant to prove the truth or other defense of what is published. And that is very clearly expressed, of course, in New York Times and Sullivan, and has been enormously important in our case law in Europe. In the United Kingdom, as in most of the states of the Union, there has been remarkably little interest by Parliament in reforming this area of the law. Libel law, as I'm sure most of you know, comes in the common law system from the medieval ecclesiastical courts and from the Court of Star Chamber. The Court of Star Chamber produced four crimes, speech crimes, obscene libel, blasphemous libel, seditious libel, and criminal libel. And criminal libel then gave rise to civil libel. And so we started the problem in the common law in medieval and 17th century times. And throughout the period since then, Parliament has very scarcely intervened at all, leaving it all to judges and lawyers like us to fashion and modify the principles. And I think many members of the English libel bar and many English judges would say that they are the best people to deal with this area of law, and these elected politicians should not be allowed a say in it. The dramatic change which is going on in the United Kingdom is that Parliament, for the first time, is taking a comprehensive look at the whole of civil libel law. And because we don't have a written constitution, we don't have the bias which exists in the Irish Republic, whose constitution is biased too strongly in favor of reputation and not sufficiently strongly in favor of free speech. We don't have that disadvantage. We start only with the European Human Rights Convention from which to get some fundamental values. What I did, being a specialist in producing private members' bills to try to change the world, what I did was simply to find a senior retired libel judge, Sir Brian Neil, and one of the few libel practitioners in favor of reform, Heather Rogers, QC. I sat them down with a former parliamentary counsel and said, look, let us try to produce a bill, because I bet after the next election, whoever wins power will want to please the newspapers, and they might well do something about the law of libel. And the NGOs had already prepared the ground in their campaign that Jonathan has mentioned. And we then formed a group of NGOs consisting of Article 19, Index on Censorship, English Pen, Sense About Science, the in-house lawyers of the broadsheets and of the broadcasters. And for a year, we thought carefully about what should be in a bill. That was a lot of work, and it paid off, because it was the first private member's bill off the stocks immediately after the coalition won power. And I then wrote to 150 members of the House of Lords to persuade them to come and speak on the 9th of July in the debate on it. And that produced about 10 outstanding speakers. You have to do that kind of thing if you're a campaigner. And during that debate on the 9th of July, the government indicated that they would produce their own draft bill, and they would then consult upon it. And so for some months they did so. And this is the right way, by the way, to make law. It's nice and slow, it's careful, it's considered, and it involves having an open mind about answers to some of the difficult problems. And so they eventually produced a draft bill, and then they had a public consultation on the draft bill, which is in that document, which closed in late June, where they asked a lot of important questions about what the law should be. And then they set up this joint committee of both houses of parliament with one or two lawyers on it, but most of them were not lawyers at all. They were from the media, they were historians, they were drawn from a wide cross-section of both houses. And frankly, I am amazed by what they have produced this week. Amazed because it is extremely well written, it's very wise. Most of its judgment calls seem to me to be right. If we could actually get most of what they're advocating in this report into an actual bill and then get the actual bill through, I would be over the moon. There are one or two bits and pieces of it where I don't agree. For example, Victor's already mentioned one, the defense of fair comment, which they relabel honest opinion. They say that mere opinion shouldn't be protected. And I don't understand that. It seems to me that mere opinion is exactly what should be. If I say that I saw an appalling production of Othello and the person who played Iago was completely deficient in all respects, that seems to me what critics should be allowed to do. The only fact that you need to prove is that you were there at the time and not in bad faith. But that's a detail. The principles, let me just talk about principles and not detail. The principles which we are seeking to achieve can be summed up in this way. First of all, to strike a fair balance between private reputation and public information as protected by the constitutional right to free speech. The notion of fair balance is critical because we'd never get it through Parliament, it wouldn't pass muster in Europe. Secondly, instead of changing the burden of proof back upon the claimant, which we would never have got through, in my view, politically, and in any case, wouldn't really work so well, what we are doing is to widen and clarify all of the defenses to English libel law. Defenses of privilege, of fair comment, of justification, of innocent dissemination, in accordance always with the public interest. And the public interest defense is designed to encourage journalism to be a profession and not only a business. So you get special rewards if you act in a professional way and can then publish untruths, provided you don't act irresponsibly. Thirdly, as has been said by Victor, there's the requirement for the claimant to have to show real harm, serious harm, before you can sue at all. Fourthly, to handicap the corporation by the necessity to get permission to sue and to show likelihood of serious financial loss. Now, that's been the bane of my life, the problem about corporations, because some in the lobby, some in the free speech lobby have said, you must stop companies from being able to sue for defamation altogether. And I have never accepted that that is the case, and let me try to explain why. The word company covers everyone from McDonald's, McDonald to Anthony Lester's dress company, the one-person dress company. It can be a multinational corporation, it can be a tiny corporate body, it can be a not-for-profit organization. Calling it a company tells you very little. What one is really trying to do is to deal with the inequality of power between a big party and a small party. And by merely handicapping the company as such, you don't really deal with the problem. And the report deals with that in a very interesting way, how you try to secure what Europe calls equality of arms. Then we seek to encourage the speedy resolution of disputes without going near a judge. And one of the really controversial things, which Harry has spoken a lot about, is effective self-regulation. How can you have a system in which the media, especially the print media, the electronic media are already regulated by Ofcom, but how do you have a system of effective self-regulation which will keep the judges away from making editorial and reporting judgments themselves? In my view, you need three things. You need adequate resources for such a body. You need its independence. And you need its ability to give effective remedies. We don't have those three in what we have at the moment. I'm sure that we will have to move in that direction if we are to achieve what we are trying to. Then I've almost finished. Trial by jury, well, there hardly are any juries left. We abolished them in 1933, except for libel and assault. You still have them. We only have them in serious criminal cases. But the media have said that they no longer trust juries to protect free speech. They would rather have a judge alone giving a reasoned judgment and being able to appeal. And then there are some interesting questions which I won't bore you with about parliamentary privilege, except to say that one of the most obnoxious provisions in our law arose when, Jonathan will mention, will remember this, when Neil Hamilton was accused of accepting cash for asking questions as a member of parliament. He sued The Guardian for libel, and a judge decided wrongly at first instance that he couldn't because of parliamentary privilege. So he went to John Major, who was then the Prime Minister, and threatened to bring down the government unless Major agreed to amend our libel law to allow members of parliament to pick and choose when to use parliamentary privilege as defendants or claimants in libel proceedings. And I'm sorry to say that is still on the statute book. So there's stuff that's not actually in this report for some reason, but that is there. so far as the future is concerned, what's going to happen? Well, I don't know whether one can trust number 10 and their phone calls. I don't really trust politicians anyhow, whoever they are. But I believe that that if there is enough support from the media and the international bar and the international media, then we may be able to persuade the government business managers to give this priority next May. It's not at all clear to me that they will. Not at all clear to me. But so there needs to be a campaign about that, I think. Secondly, there'll have to be negotiation between now and then to make good this report in the actual legislation and other procedural changes. Thirdly, then, it has to get through both houses. Now, one of the curious contrasts between the United Kingdom and the United States is that in the United Kingdom, if governments want to legislate, they can and do and succeed in getting their way, whereas you have a very interesting system of government here where presidents not only can they not get legislation, they can't even get the courts to abide by the judgments of the International Court of Justice in death penalty cases. We don't have that kind of system. We have a system of parliamentary government, which you rebelled against and set up your own system, which manages to handicap George III so well that now the Senate can filibuster anything at all. Well, we don't have that. So the curious thing in our system is that if this law is properly shaped and introduced, it will get through. And when it does get through, it will, I think, have a profound effect, at least in the common law world, which is, after all, at least one-third of the world. And it might even have some effect in the land of the free and the home of the brave at state level when states consider what to do about their libel laws, because I don't actually think that New York Times and Sullivan and its progeny have solved all the problems here either. So there we are. I'm very pleased. Oh, it's finally the internet. I quite agree with Victor that having an absolute immunity for internet service providers is not a great idea. And in any case, in Europe, it would violate European Union law. And you couldn't. But I think this committee have come up with an ingenious compromise, which is to say you don't have to take it down if you put a notice up saying it's being challenged. And only if you don't put up that notice might you have to do so. That's an interesting idea. Libel tourism, well, the campaigners love to use libel tourism as an example, but actually, as this committee says, there are not very many cases where libel tourism in recent years has been a real problem. But it's a marvelous issue to raise, and I believe the measures to deal with it are sensible. And finally, President Obama and the Speech Act. Now, what President Obama did in the Speech Act, as you know, was to prevent English judgments from being enforced in the United States. We did the same for Malaysia and Singapore. We do not allow foreign governments to rely upon their libel laws in English courts unless it would be unlawful under English law as well, which is basically what the Speech Act does. Now, I'm very pleased that that happened here because it gave an impetus, part of the impetus to our reform. But what it, oddly enough, doesn't cover is privacy any more than ours does. So you probably need to immunize yourselves against privacy claims as well as others in your Speech Act Part 2. Sorry to have gone on for so long. It's Arié's fault for making me speak when I hadn't slept for so long. But thank you very much.
Okay. Thank you. I think we ought to go directly to questions from those who are assembled here. So if you would go to the microphone if you want to ask a question. Go ahead, Marjorie
Hines. I'm a former Open Society Institute fellow, a writer and a lawyer. used to work for the ACLU. So New York Times v. Sullivan, what I didn't hear in any of these wonderful presentations, and congratulations that this has gotten this far, is whether what I think of as the three essential elements of Times v. Sullivan are incorporated. I think Lord Lester suggested that the issue of truth or falsity is still under this law going to be on, the burden will be on the defendant to prove truth, whereas in Times v. Sullivan, one of the important points was the burden must be on the plaintiff to prove falsity. The other two elements, I'm not sure I heard any description of what this legislation would do, so I'd be interested in knowing. If the plaintiff is a public official, or after Times v. Sullivan got extended, a public figure, then the burden is on the plaintiff to show not only falsity, but that the falsity was published with knowledge of its falsity or reckless disregard for truth or falsity. Is that addressed anywhere? And the third one is the clear and convincing evidence standard. Under Times v. Sullivan, the plaintiff has to show, not just by preponderance of the evidence, but by clear and convincing evidence that that the defamation occurred. So the question is really factual. What does the legislation say about those crucial elements of Times v. Sullivan? And if it doesn't conform to Times v. Sullivan, why not?
Can I try to answer that? I mean, it's a key question. I argued a case called Reynolds, in which I tried to bring New York Times and Sullivan into English law. There are one or two conceptual problems about it. One is that whereas in New York Times and Sullivan itself, the basis of the reasoning was to do with it being a public official, in that case a police officer, and government. And the case, if you remember, that they cited was City of Chicago, the Illinois case in the 20s, which relied heavily upon democracy and the idea that public officials shouldn't be allowed to benefit from the Alabama law, which was the same as English law. You then moved on from that, the public figure expanded so that a football coach would come within it. And one of the things that puzzled, I think, my judges was, what was the principle once you did that? Why should a football coach be equated with a public official? But the second problem was, why was the identity of the claimant crucial rather than a test of public interest so far as the content of the publication was concerned? Is it not more sensible, as the German Constitutional Court does, to look at content and not just identity of claimant? I did manage in another case called Derbyshire County Council and Bookbinder to get the judges to say, which is not what you say, that a government body as such is not allowed to use libel law at all. We have got an absolute bar, but we allow them to go by what's called malicious falsehood, which is exactly what you've just described. It's the different tort where you have to show reckless disregard of truth or bad faith. But that's why, historically, we didn't go as far as that. So so far as lawmaking is concerned, it was much more, you'd never get a law, bear in mind that members of parliament of both houses are self-interested. They hate newspapers.
I'm shocked.
They hate newspapers, and they love defending their reputations and their private lives. So to get a bill through both houses required thinking very carefully of how to do it. And the key, it seemed to me, to doing it was not to simply crudely adopt the Sullivan rule, but to do it in a more indirect way. And the way we did it was to take the public interest defense to this Reynolds case and to expand it greatly, which we have done, and which this committee is advocating, so that a newspaper or NGO can publish defamatory and inaccurate facts. I'll say it again, can publish inaccurate and defamatory facts, can do so, provided they can show responsible journalism. and in other words, no bad faith or recklessness. Mm-hmm. Now, that comes extremely close to Sullivan, but in a slightly different form. Secondly, on the defense of justification, we've modified that to prove not the whole truth, but only the substantial justification. Thirdly, on the defense of fair comment or honest opinion, we require very little fact in order to, quote, justify an opinion. And fourthly, and very important, what we call statutory qualified privilege. This is where you have a fair and accurate report of the proceedings of all kinds of things, annual general meetings of companies, government bodies, scientific conferences, what you name it. We have now expanded that lot so that there is a wide variety of clear answers, public meeting, a meeting, if this is a public meeting, which it probably is, then defamatory statements reported about what I said here, that Lester is a crook or an idiot, would be perfectly fine if it's accurately reported. Mm-hmm. So we've expanded in those other ways, but we haven't simply adopted the American rule. There is an argument for adopting the American rule. It would not be acceptable, certainly, I think, within the European Court of Human Rights, and it wouldn't be acceptable to our parliament. I hope I've answered the question.
Yes, and you know, it is true that at times Sullivan tends to be worshipped here in legal circles as some kind of brilliant solution to the problem, which I think you mentioned. It's not. It leaves many problems, including the inquiry into state of mind because of the malice standard. So, thank you.
And also the privacy point. I mean, Times, the Time Inc. case, we regard that as bizarre because Brennan, Bill Brennan used...
We could debate that one.
But I mean, no, but Bill Brennan used New York Times and Sullivan to apply it to privacy, and I think Tony Lewis, on, as far as I'm concerned, was pervasive.
Thank you.
I would only add to the question, why not, is they don't have a First Amendment, and Times Sullivan was written by 9 justices, and this is going to be written by a legislative body, and it's remarkable as to what it's going to do,
right.
But it's not reasonable to expect that they could do more.
Well, and those libertarians, Black and Douglas, didn't think Brennan had gone far enough.
Exactly.
My name is Elena Sassauer, and I'm director and co-founder of a nonpartisan, nonprofit citizens organization called Center for Judicial Accountability. In that capacity, I've had 20 years of interaction with the press, because in order to make reform, you need the press to report on what needs to be changed. Unfortunately, the press is not heterogeneous. It is allied with the establishment. And what it does is not just suppress report of the corruption that needs to be exposed so as to make change, but to the extent that it reports on the activities of activists, it minimizes, degrades, disparages them. It defames them. I have been a libel plaintiff, and I am now a libel plaintiff. I have, in 2 lawsuits, sued the most powerful media entities, or among the most powerful media entities in this country, the New York Times and Gannett. This has given me an up-close and personal look.
Could you actually frame a question?
Yes. Open Society prides itself on dialogue. And I see here only the advocates of what is touted as libel reform in the United Kingdom. I would be interested in hearing the other side. I also am very troubled.
Can I ask,
yes.
What's the question?
All right, let's be specific. Mr. Kovner, The example that you gave of Mr. Adelson, who was so, okay. All of your examples seem to be powerful, you call them claimants. But there are also claimants who aren't powerful, who are ordinary people, who have been defamed, besmirched, and maybe they cannot show substantial
Again,
damages.
If you'd ask
okay,
the question.
Why did you say, Mr. Kovner, and would the others agree with what he said, that the description of Mr. Adelson would have been laughable and quickly dismissed in this country, and what he was saying as it should be? Why was Mr. Adelson not entitled to his day in court?
There are many reasons, because that paragraph I read contained no false facts about him, and they were the commentary on him was obviously the opinion of among others. That kind of expression of opinion is absolutely protected under a long line of U.S. Supreme Court cases.
Okay,
I'm not having.
Of course, I would just conclude.
Argument.
Yeah,
I'm just simply asking people to come to the microphone if they want to ask a question.
Right, right.
And so, if there are others who wish,
I would just say that obviously I don't know the specifics, but what I would just offer to the panelists is that you need to examine what is going on in the cases themselves. Too often the decisions don't.
You're perfectly right. You're perfectly right.
Too often the decisions don't reflect the record.
You're perfectly right. The little claimant, rather than the big rich one, must have a right of access to court. Must have. And under what we're talking about, they do. They do. I am not in any way unbalanced in my approach. It's very important the right to reputation is properly protected. If you take Mr. George Soros as a good example of someone who is not a little person at all, he is defamed every day by Fox News. Mm. He has no remedy under the American legal system. I think he probably should do myself, but that's beside the point. Our bill gives much more rights to claimants, and that's why it will get through.
To reiterate that point, we have never advocated, although sometimes we've been caricatured as advocating the removal of libel or the rendering of libel to be so insignificant as people do not have the right to a reputation. That has simply never been on the table. What we have sought to do in a David and Goliath way has been to rebalance libel in favor of freedom of expression, which in a country such as ours, without a First Amendment, is a tradable commodity. It is not a fundamental right. But there is nothing in the bill, there is nothing in the jurisprudence that does anything to remove the right of the small person against the monolithic media organization. And the point that I referred to towards the end of my short presentation was the issue of media standards and these broader questions that the Leveson Inquiry in a UK context is looking at, which is bad media, which is corporate bullying, which is political quiescence, and a media of a very narrow disposition, dismissing other thoughts and other areas, is a weakness and needs to be looked at, but nothing that we are advocating would in any way weaken the rights of the individual claimant.
I would hope so.
I guess a historical question, a present question. Historically, Lord Lester, I'm sorry, during your education among all the Supreme Court justices, you didn't talk more to Thurgood Marshall about what's wrong with public interest being decided by the incumbent judges and therefore a plaintiff-centered system having something to be said for it in terms of self-help, access to the media, all the things that the Supreme Court has said in order to prevent the public interest being decided by the very, you know, incumbent political group that might be less likely to think that the attack is, in fact, in the public interest. But on present stuff, I wish somebody would explain the takedown stuff before I tell Victor that he's all wrong. Could somebody please describe those provisions of the bill? Because, of course, those are of great interest to us.
I didn't understand the first part, but I mean, were you talking about bias in the Supreme Court? I don't know. But the on the internet, the problem about the internet is that on the one hand, it increases free speech hugely across the world. On the other hand, it can cause serious harm much more across the world because of defamatory and invasive statements that can be made via the internet. And the puzzle is what you do about a legal regime that is balanced in that context, especially since there are about 190 countries with 190 different laws, and yet the internet service provider is having to take the risk in all of those places. And it probably cries out in the end for treaty negotiation and international regulation. In Europe, we have something called the Directive on e-commerce, and what that, which is now being looked at. What that does basically is to say across the 27 European states that internet service providers, if they are put on notice of something which is defamatory, must either defend it or take it down within a reasonable time. That is the so-called notice and takedown provision. When I was trying to work out what to put in my bill, what I was slightly surprised about was that it was the in-house lawyers of the BBC, Channel 4, The Times, and The Guardian, who said, as Victor has, you can't have an absolute immunity. You have to have some kind of responsible journalistic obligation, more than a merely passive provider, facilitator. And it was they, above all, who resisted what Yahoo and Google wanted. Yahoo and Google wanted an open situation. So where my bill is a bit too conservative, actually. The Joint Committee commenting on it suggested something a bit less conservative. But it's a really tricky issue. Social media is even trickier with blogs and Twitter and all that kind of stuff. So the ministers in Britain have insisted, against the wishes of the civil servants, that we must deal with that in the legislation. I'm very glad they have.
Now, if the New York Times publishes a classified ad, which is inappropriately gender specific or has racial qualities to it, it is, you know, it's come over the transom and up it goes. They're responsible. Pittsburgh Press, they're liable. But if Craigslist publishes thousands and thousands of ads that are racist and sexist and vicious, they are protected by Section 230 immunity, and I don't think that the members of the Congress had any sense that that's what they were doing when they passed that bill with that scope in the mid-90s.
Yeah, I'll make my question quick and direct. Could you expand a little bit on the... my name is Robert Chacon, I'm just a citizen. Anyhow, the issue of the efforts towards equality of arms that you just briefly mentioned, could you expand a little bit on that, please? I think it's pertinent to a couple of the questions that were raised, and I think it's sort of an interesting issue that...
We don't give legal aid in libel claims. So libel claims are brought by lawyers who operate a conditional fee agreement or contingent fee arrangement, which Victor's already described. The result is that, say, a newspaper may find itself liable to pay £20,000 damages and £250,000 in legal costs. There is therefore a pressing need, first of all, to get a level playing field by stopping the rich and the powerful from being able to, and especially the rich and powerful lawyers, the greedy lawyers, from being able to exploit the position in that way. And that is one of the things that the government have pledged to do, quite apart from my bill. Well, the second problem,
by capping costs and by preventing the conditional fee agreements from being
capping
abused.
Legal fee costs?
Yes. But the second problem is what do you do when you have, it can be either way. You can have a small claimant and a powerful defendant, or you can have a big, powerful claimant and a small defendant. For example, there's a case, well, I won't go through the detail, but how do you secure a more level playing field? One of the solutions that the Joint Committee report advocates is that corporations should not be able to bring a case without the leave of the judge in the first place. And the judge would no doubt impose conditions upon
something like Rule 11 in the United States.
I don't know, but it's a very difficult problem. In the one case that showed the vice, the McLibel case in my country, McDonald's was accused of all kinds of malpractices, and two or three consumer individuals had to defend themselves against the corporation for 2 years without legal aid. And the European Court of Human Rights said that that violated equality of arms. And that's one of the reasons why trying to level the playing field is very important. There are a number of procedural changes being suggested in this report that may, but these are very much not US type reforms.
A lot of it comes down to the small detail. And when I was an editor, I remember we had a fantastic story on party funding by a company that we had discovered was illegally selling weapons to Sudan. And we received, in those days, it was 5 years ago, the steaming facts from the claimant law firm. Anyway, to cut a long story short, the reason I buckled, to my eternal shame, was as much the question and the fear of costs as the fear of time. And you know, these cases can go on for many years. And just very quickly, some bullet points from the Mawini Joint Committee report. We agree with the government's intention of promoting early resolution by allowing the judge to determine key issues in question at an initial hearing within a few weeks, certainly not months. But they argue that the government does not go far enough. We as organizations, together with a committee chaired by a former High Court judge, Justice Sedley, have been doing work on early neutral evaluation, mediation, and arbitration. And some of that has been adapted into this, but they also talk about some suggestions include the application, perish the thought for lawyers, of maximum hourly rates, mandatory capping of recoverable costs, and what they talk about, more aggressive case management by judges in a robust manner that minimizes delays and costs. So that will go some way, I think.
Thank you.
I'll take one more question, we've reached the time that we said this would end. So what I'd like to do is have you ask your question very briefly and get a very brief response.
That's fine.
Okay.
My understanding is that that our freedom of speech and freedom of the press are very, very much linked, probably as the general principles are in Britain, to achieving an electorate that is able to really exercise democracy based on facts. And my impression, and those of some others are, is that particularly the electronic media here have strayed very much from that and been allowed to stray, certainly since the idea of the obligation of balance has been removed, and strayed into a situation that news has become very frequently replaced by editorial judgment, which sometimes is replaced into being strategic communication for particular interest groups. And I'm wondering, on both sides of the Atlantic, if you have any feeling how to restore journalism to its proper place. Thanks.
Mm-hmm. I think the question was appropriately brief. I think the answer cannot be brief to that.
Briefly.
Okay.
The puzzle, we regulate the electronic media with fair balance requirements still. Some say we should do the same with the print media. You can't really, in my view, do that. My bill builds in incentives that if a newspaper or broadcaster errs in the way they report, and they do so in a defamatory way, they have a defense of public interest, but only if they act responsibly. And one of the factors to take into account is have they complied with their own professional codes. The press don't like that very much, but it's a way of trying to introduce more responsibility into journalism without getting involved in litigation. So I quite understand the question. And you have to build in incentives for responsible journalism without sacrificing free speech.
And with that, this is the issue that we knock our heads about day in, day out. And it will take the new Commission of Inquiry in the UK a year. And they've had two public hearings so far, both of which were absolutely fascinating. But your question is framed in exactly the right way. There is the libel changes are not specific to newspapers. We, as I say, have been dealing with doctors. There's a famous case of a doctor who was sued, a UK doctor sued for making remarks at a peer-reviewed medical conference in Seattle to a Canadian newspaper, and then sued through the London courts. And there's some good defense, qualified privilege defense for doctors. For medics and scientists and academics in this new bill, which we haven't discussed, so it's not a media-specific issue. But on the question of media standards, there is that one person put it quite well at the Leveson Inquiry last week when people talk about newspapers and newspaper behavior and all of that, with the great internet peering on from afar, are we not just rearranging the deck chairs on the Titanic? And there is that sense. It's the economics of journalism that's really at issue, to answer your question.
Victor, any final comments? I think we've had an excellent exploration of the subject for this evening, and I'm very grateful to the panel members. Thank you very much.